It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll find out what's next now that a guilty verdict's been reached in the trial of the surviving Boston Marathon bomber.
First, just one day after Wisconsin voters showed their support for a constitutional amendment that paves the way for the state Supreme Court to elect its chief justice, the current chief announced she's fighting back.
The conservative majority on the court is expected to vote off the current chief justice, Shirley Abrahamson, but yesterday, Abrahamson filed a federal lawsuit to block that effort. She says removal from her position before her term is over is a violation of her constitutional rights.
Joining us now to discuss Abrahamson's challenge and what's at stake here is Howard Schwaber. He's a professor of political science and legal affairs at UW-Madison. Howard, thanks for joining us again.
Oh, my pleasure.
So Chief Abrahamson is filing this lawsuit. She says switching now would be an infringement of her constitutional rights. What exactly is she challenging in this case?
Well, she's making a couple of claims, and I have to say that one of them is just terrifically dear to the heart of anyone who teaches constitutional law, because it goes all the way back to 1803 and Marbury versus Madison. We remember that case as the most famous case about judicial review, but what it was specifically about was a judge who'd been offered a position on a bench, and then the new administration refused to deliver it. And he claimed, and the Supreme Court agreed, that he had a property right in that judicial position. So Abrahamson is in part arguing that she has a property right to be Chief Justice, in the same way that one would have a right to owning a piece of owning a house, for instance, or perhaps a job guaranteed under a contract. I think that argument is not very strong, and the reason is that Abrahamson holds the position of Chief Justice because of the operation of a statute, and statutes changed. That is, it's not the situation where she was promised a judgeship and then it was rescinded, and it's also not the situation you have in some states where a person is elected directly to the position of Chief Justice. Either of those would be a different situation. In our situation, justices are elected to the Supreme Court in general, and then the process for deciding who is Chief Justice operates according to a statute. And changing that statute is not a regulatory action that deprives someone of a property interest in the traditional sense of that word.
And what she's challenging here, she's not saying, hey, overturn this constitutional amendment. She's saying, don't apply this constitutional amendment yet because I'm in the middle of my term as Chief Justice. Do I have that right?
You do, and that brings me to the second argument that she's raising, which is that the amendment is perfectly fine, but it shouldn't apply, as she would argue it, retroactively. And there's a couple of pieces to this argument. One is Chief Justice Abrahamson is arguing that voters who voted for the amendment understood that it would apply prospectively to the next time a Chief Justice is selected. She's also been joined in her lawsuit by several individual voters who say that when they voted for her reelection to the Supreme Court the last time around, they intended to vote for her to be Chief Justice. Again, I don't think these arguments are terribly strong. I think it would be very difficult to show that the bulk of voters in Wisconsin who voted for the referendum had really thought about the question of prospective or retrospective application. And the fact, you know, that one votes for a member of Congress hoping that he'll be the chair of a committee doesn't mean he has a right to be the chair of that committee, as Congress has proven many times over.
Now, I don't like to throw around the word unprecedented because I'm usually wrong when I say it, but it doesn't seem like this kind of thing comes up very much. Have there been similar cases like this in Wisconsin or around the country?
I'm not aware of a similar case like this anywhere. Now, I haven't researched that question in depth, so like you, I'm not 100%. I'm not at all certain that there's no other case like it, but I can tell you that I've never heard of one, and I've been studying this stuff for some time. It is, I think, crucial to keep in mind the background of all of this. I mean, this referendum was not adopted, did not come out of the air. This was a get Shirley Abrahamson measure. And it's part of the attempt by the conservatives to take complete control of the court. On the court itself, there's a 4-3 conservative majority. It's also the case that, for example, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce drafted a rule dramatically relaxing conflict of interest restrictions and saw to it that was adopted. That's the rule that's now allowing those four justices, or may allow those four justices, to rule on the case against Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce in connection with the Walker investigation. This is part and parcel of the process we've seen over the last 8 or 10 years of $8 million of outside money being funneled into Wisconsin judicial elections and Republican Party operatives and the Republican Party becoming directly involved in finding candidates and running their campaigns. In other words, this is of a piece the conservative effort to transform what was once widely regarded as a nonpartisan institution into another piece of policymaking apparatus along with the legislature and the governor's office. There's also, for example, a bill in the legislature to set an age limit on service in the Supreme Court, and that, too, is aimed directly at Shirley Abramson in the assumption that if she can be gotten rid of, she'll be replaced by someone more to their liking. Now, the fact that Anne Walsh Bradley was reelected on Tuesday, you know, suggests that that's not necessarily true. And when you adopt a new rule like this, the rule sticks around, right? We may easily find ourselves in a situation a few years down the road where a liberal majority in the court is voting out a conservative chief justice, or where heavy donors to liberal candidates come before the court, and the justice who received those donations is allowed to preside over their case because of these rules that Wisconsin Manufacturing and Commerce wrote. So in the long run, it's always, you know, it's always a mistake to be willing to sacrifice the integrity of the institution for a partisan gain. But in the short term, that does seem to be exactly what's happening.
Talking to Howard Schwaber about the new way of choosing the state's chief justice of the Supreme Court, just passed in referendum on Tuesday, and a challenge by the current Supreme Court Chief Justice Shirley Abrahamson to the way that law would work. Well, Howard, let's talk a little bit about what's at stake here. There's a 4-3 conservative majority, as you mentioned. The Chief Justice doesn't get a bonus vote. Nope. So what extra special powers does the Chief Justice get?
That's right. I mean, we are not talking about dramatic substantive powers. As you say, the Chief Justice doesn't get two votes. And the fact of Chief Justice status does not mean that a case would come out, you know, one way rather than another way. At a personal level, she stands to lose $8,000 in salary, although there is also a bill in front of the, before the legislature to equalize Supreme Court justice salaries, so that would take that element away. The Chief Justice has a lot of administrative authority, and anyone who's ever worked in an office knows that whoever controls the administration of the office has a great deal of control over what happens there. The Chief Justice has a number of substantive duties or authorities, such as assigning judges to cases in certain circumstances and ruling on uncontested motions. But I think in some ways the biggest piece of this is that the Chief Justice is the public face of the court. And I think the conservatives on the court and Governor Walker and conservatives in the legislature who promoted this referendum measure want very much to have one of their own as the face of the court. And if I had to choose one thing that is most substantively at stake here, I think that's probably it.
There's been a lot of talk, more a couple years ago, about incivility, extreme incivility among Supreme Court justices here in Wisconsin. One argument made by people in support of this amendment is if we elect the justice, they'll have to make nice with people to get them to vote for him or her. This is a road to better, to a more civil Supreme Court in the future. Is there anything to that?
I think that's exactly wrong, honestly, although, again, only because of the particular context. I should back up a little bit. There are at least four ways that I know of that different state Supreme Courts select their Chief Justice. It can be an appointment by the governor. It can be elected by the other justices, which is the system we're moving to. It can be based on seniority. Or in some states, when the chief justiceship comes open, candidates run for that specific office. As I mentioned earlier, if we had that system, if Shirley Abrahamson had been elected to be chief justice, right, we'd be having a significantly different conversation at this point, I think. As for the effects on civility, you know, I think it's reasonably clear that what's been driving the incivility on the court is the increasing incivility of campaigns. Again, just 10 years ago, Wisconsin was considered to have one of the most honest, one of the least partisan, one of the least political Supreme Courts in the country. It's now regarded as one of the most vulnerable to corruption and the most politically partisan. And the reason has been a dramatic shift, particularly in the elections that resulted in Justices Gableman and Ziegler taking the bench. Those elections were brutal. And extremely partisan, and marked by advertising that was not merely highly negative, but in at least one case, arguably crossed the line into unethical. Interestingly, on Tuesday, we didn't see so much of that. Tuesday's election was certainly hard-fought, and there was a fair amount of money poured into the election, but it didn't blanket the airwaves, and it didn't result in the kind of public bitterness that past elections have had. So it's possible that the voters in Wisconsin have sort of had enough of this circus. I very much hope that's the case. And just as I hope that voters in Wisconsin, you know, will think more about the integrity of their institution rather than their preferences, or as much as their preferences in the immediate term for policy outcomes. But what's driving the incivility is just the bitter polarization on the court itself. And as long as the process of candidate selection is so polarized and so politicized, I would not expect to find a return to the days of nonpartisan civility on the court itself.
Howard, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal affairs at UW-Madison, joining us to talk about Chief Justice Shirley Abrahamson's legal challenge over the new process for selecting the state Supreme Court's Chief Justice.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look back at one of the longest education strikes in American history here in Wisconsin.
First, a jury returned a guilty verdict yesterday at the trial of Jakar Tsarnaev, the surviving Boston Marathon bomber.
The jury heard from 95 witnesses over 16 days and found Tsarnaev guilty on all 30 charges, 17 of which could send him to death row in this federal case.
Joining us now with a look back at the trial and what could happen next is Jennifer Levitz. She's been covering the Tsarnaev trial for the Wall Street Journal. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, it took more than 20 minutes yesterday for the jury to announce its verdict in its entirety. What was the scene like yesterday as they read through that decision?
Well, it was there was a lot of tension at the courthouse. They'd been deliberating for about 11 hours, and some people were thinking, you know, why are they taking so long? Because he admitted he did it, but they did have 30 charges to go through, and then each of those had subcounts. And we went into the courtroom, and there were families there. There were survivors. There's people there who've lost legs and they're on prosthetic legs. And so the clerk said right away that for everyone to contain their emotions when they came out. And Jakar Tsarnaev came out and sort of sat between his lawyers, and they kind of patted his back as they've been doing through the trial. And then they read it. And what was so surprising, as you said, it was every single count. And I guess it was surprising because there was these little there was counts underneath them, subcounts, and it was just one guilty after another, and it took about 25 minutes, and people were just stone-faced looking at him for any kind of emotion. And then after we stood up and left, and I saw one of the mother of the youngest victim, Martin Richard, just linger in her row and look over at Jakar Tsarnaev and wipe tears away, and her husband was kind of rubbing her back, and it was very emotional.
As you said, the culpability of Tsarnaev wasn't at issue here. So, what kind of portrait did the defense try to paint of him?
Their strategy was to just admit that he did it. They flat out admitted that he walked down the street and put a bomb near the finish line while his brother put another one nearby. They admitted that he was with his brother when a police officer was shot, that he was with his brother when the carjacking occurred, that he was part of a police shootout and hurled explosives at police. But their whole strategy was that to say that he was coerced by his older brother, Tamerlan, who died 4 days after the bombings. And Tamerlan was 26, while at the time, Jakar was 19. So the message was this is an adolescent. They used that word a lot. He was a teenager. And that he was sort of under the thumb of this controlling, strict older brother, who really was the real radical who had introduced his younger brother to these extremist writings and had really been the mastermind and the main mover behind this whole plot.
You said during the reading of the verdict, people were watching Tsarnaev closely for any emotion. Was there any emotion? What was his demeanor like?
No, he has betrayed no emotion throughout this whole trial, which has been frustrating to some of the observers. He comes in. He would come in every day. He's dressed in a suit. He does chat with his lawyers, but he never would look at the courtroom. And during the proceedings, he's usually looking down. And yesterday, again, he was sort of looking down at the paperwork, which is probably the jury verdict. Sort of fidgeting. He fidgets a lot, but nothing shows on his face. We haven't seen anything like that yet, and so it's a big question as to whether we might see that in the upcoming phase.
The trial took over 16 days, and it sounds like a lot of that was really wrenching testimony that came from witnesses, that came from survivors. What kind of picture emerged of that day over the course of this trial?
The prosecution painted a picture of just an absolutely brutal attack. They showed videos, they showed photos, they had medical examiners describe in excruciating detail the way that people had died. They focused on the pain and the they tried to make this as heinous as they could, which is one of the things they need to do to get the death penalty. So they had they wanted to know how long it took people to bleed out. Were they conscious? Were they in pain? They showed you videos where you could hear people screaming. It was absolutely brutal and wrenching to see for anyone, and I can just imagine for the family members. But I think the government, in the government's view, they had to do that. They really had to show the carnage in fully.
We're talking about the verdict in the Boston Marathon bombers trial, which was reached yesterday, with Jennifer Levitz from the Wall Street Journal. And Jennifer, this is a federal case, so the death penalty is a possibility here. What comes next?
Yes. Yeah, so the next phase is the penalty phase, and the same jury will reconvene and they will decide whether to give him the death penalty or life in prison without parole. Those are the only two options. And this will be like a mini trial. It will look like a trial. The government will present witnesses, and the defense will present witnesses. But in many ways, a lot of people here feel that the real trial is now just really beginning, because in the first phase, his culpability was not in dispute. And there's a lot more uncertainty now. And so we're really going to see a lot more about him. We didn't learn a lot about who he was as a person prior to the bombings in this trial. And that's probably what we're going to start to see now, because the defense is going to want to give some reason why they should keep him alive. And the decision has to be unanimous. So they really have to convince one person on that jury that he should not be put to death.
And it's worth pointing out here that Tsarnaev's defense lawyer is Judy Clark, the lead attorney, and she successfully defended the Unabomber and Gabrielle Giffords' attacker. How significant is that? Is her role here?
She is. It's very significant. She's known for the ability to humanize her clients for the jury. She defended Susan Smith, the mother who was convicted in 1995 of strapping her sons in the car and drowning them, and she saved her from the death penalty it was the same situation. And when they went into the sentencing phase, she brought up people from her past, showed she had been a molestation victim, and really raised a lot of sympathy. And she has an interesting strategy, because I was just reading her closing arguments, and some of it could have been written by the prosecution. She's saying this was horrific, this was the worst thing, and what we've seen, the pain we've seen. So she tries to build credibility by not making excuses for her clients. But then she's trying to say there's something more, some reason to see this as a person. So we're going to see a lot more of that.
Is there any kind of unity or emerging sense among the victims about what justice should look like in this case?
I'm not sensing any consensus at this point. A lot of them are keeping their thoughts to themselves. But I've just talked with a mother of two sons, each who lost a leg, and she, to her, justice would be the death penalty. But then I just talked with another woman who was pretty badly injured, and she thinks that life in prison would be a worse sentence. So I think there's a mix of views. And I also just talked with a man, a doctor in Alabama who was hurt, and he would support the death penalty, but he also just said that would just get dragged out too long. So in a way, he doesn't think that would be the best answer either.
Now, Boston has a strong Roman Catholic presence. Does that, do you think, make a death sentence less likely?
Well, it's interesting because in order to get on the jury, it had to be a death-qualified jury, which means that everyone had to say that they would consider it. So if this worked right, everyone on that jury is open to the death penalty. But I do think that the idea that the death penalty is really not part of the DNA of the state does affect things, because you know you say you might consider it, but what do you bring to that? What's your background, and how bad does it have to be for you to consider it? I mean, interestingly, we had WBUR here, the NPR station in Boston, did a poll in March, which found that of Boston registered voters, only 27% said he should receive the death penalty. And what was striking about this poll was taken after the start of the trial, when some of the most devastating testimony had been given about the 8-year-old boy and that day. And so I think it does. It's not popular here.
Jennifer, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jennifer Levis has been covering the Tsarnaev trial for The Wall Street Journal. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Think back in Wisconsin history to a conflict between public workers on one side, government leaders on the other. Protests drag out. The community is divided. The story attracts national attention. Sounds like the Act 10 protests in 2011, yeah, but this story goes further back.
It took place in Hortonville, Wisconsin in 1974 in one of the nation's longest teacher strikes ever. The strike brought union activists from around the country and saw the formation of a self-described vigilante group in response.
Our next guest shares the story and how it echoes to this day in a new piece published by the Wisconsin Historical Society. Adam Mertz is a PhD student at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's the author of the article, The Hortonville Teacher Strike and the Public Sector Labor Dilemma, in the spring issue of the Wisconsin Magazine of History. Adam, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, happy to be on the show.
Well, take us back to this time now. You write that public employee unions were legal in Wisconsin earlier than elsewhere in the country at this time, but the vagueness of the laws then led to the potential for conflict. How so?
Exactly. So there was laws on the books allowing public sector workers to unionize, but there was really no legal mechanism to force both sides into an actual agreement. There was just a requirement that they bargain, but it wasn't necessarily that they actually reach an agreement. There was no mechanism for it.
So in this context, how common were teacher strikes in the state?
They were actually very common at this time, and they went up drastically, especially in the two years immediately preceding the 1974 strike. They went up dramatically. There were roughly 50 in those 2 years. Before Hortonville. And they were, you know, this is all public sector strikes, but most of them were teacher strikes.
And were teacher strikes legal at that point? It seems like it was a gray area.
You're absolutely right. It was a gray area as far as what would happen when a strike was there, but they were clearly illegal. And yet there was still no, just like there was no mechanism forcing them to reach an agreement, there was really no understanding about what to do when a teacher strike hit as far as how to enforce this illegality. I mean, would people just go in and start arresting teachers? What would happen? And so usually a lot of these strikes that were happening just lasted under 2 weeks before either side could really mobilize. And so these two-week strikes were really just to make a point that the teachers were serious, that they wanted to negotiate and they wanted a contract. And so once both sides agreed, the strike stopped before the 2 weeks hit, and so there wasn't too much time to mobilize opposition in either side.
So the standard script up to this point was the teachers take a shorter, almost symbolic strike. That's enough leverage. A deal is reached, right, before
exactly.
This Hortonville.
Now exactly.
Let's visit Hortonville now in 1974. What led up to the strike?
Sure. There was actually lots going on, not only locally, but statewide and nationwide. So the National Education Association, the NEA, which the Wisconsin unions were affiliated with, which we now know as WEAC, They were all undergoing these massive changes. They were going from what is usually known as a professional organization. If you think of the American Medical Association, it's a collection of doctors, and they have meetings, and they talk about pressing issues and talk about best practices, and they meet every year, but they're not a union. And that is what the NEA and WEAC was up to, really, the very end of the 1960s. But during this time, you had a reorganization, and so they made themselves more into what we would recognize as a union. And this, of course, was kind of a competition that the NEA had with the American Federation of Teachers, which had long recognized itself as a union. So the NEA was reorganizing to be like the AFT. And so they kicked out administrators. They embraced collective bargaining like a regular union. And so there really was going to be a test case to see if these new innovations in the NEA, how that was all going to play out. And it turned out that the test case was in the Hortonville School District, which the HEA, the Hortonville Education Association, had 88 members at the time.
Talking to Adam Mertz about the Hortonville teacher strike of 1974, a turning point in public worker union history in the state. So we've got this context, a script where teacher strikes last 2 weeks and then they're over. Then we've got people looking for a test case in this small town Hortonville, a little northwest of Lake Winnebago. How did this escalate? Why did this get so protracted where other ones had wrapped up quickly?
Sure. So part of the reason is that, I mean, the Hortonville teachers were facing similar circumstances as elsewhere. It had been a while since they've gotten a raise. They had been, so by the time January of 1974 had been around, they had been working without a contract since the beginning of that school year, since September of 1973. And so they really wanted to send a point that they wanted to have a contract. And kind of on the other side, the reason things got so out of hand in Hortonville in particular was that the local was so small. It's easy to find 88 replacement teachers and to talk to them a little bit and have kind of face-to-face meetings, whereas in the same general area of Wisconsin, Manitowoc was having close to having a teacher strike, but they had roughly 300 teachers. Appleton was also very close to having a teacher strike. They had 600 teachers. And then in Wisconsin Rapids was on a two-week strike in early January, and they had about 350 teachers. So it's a lot harder for the administration to organize replacement teachers. It's a lot easier to come to negotiations that way. And this just didn't happen in Hortonville. The board decided to dig in its feet, and as did the Hortonville teachers. And so they just had a standoff.
And this quickly became a statewide thing and a national thing. Can you talk about groups outside of Hortonville who ended up being involved in this as it dragged on?
Absolutely. So, again, this was kind of a test case. It became one. It's debatable about whether or not everyone thought it was going to be at the time. But people recognized, especially once the Hortonville board fired the striking teachers, people recognized that this was a very, very important case. And so groups around the state, so WEAC and the Wisconsin Association of School Boards got really involved, the WASB, because, of course, if teachers could strike like this, there was a threat to local school board control. And so they were opposing the strike and upholding the Hortonville School Board firing the teachers. And then national interests got involved, too. So the Nationwide Association of School Boards and even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce got involved.
How divisive was this for the Hortonville community?
It was very, very divisive. And it, like I said, it didn't start out quite that way. But once both sides dug their heels in, it really got out of hand. All of these protesters came into Hortonville, and they did some tactics that weren't just being on the picket line. They would go into local merchants and kind of harass them to try to compel the town into reaching a decision that would favor the teachers. They had massive rallies to support the teachers. And so all of this really escalated things. And similarly, you mentioned the Hortonville vigilantes. That didn't help things. And the Hortonville School Board bringing in representatives from the WASB also escalated things.
And I mentioned parallels with Act 10 earlier, and one of the most striking ones seems to be the battle for public opinion. This was a publicity battle, among many other things. Can you talk about how that swayed from the beginning to its conclusion?
Absolutely. So that is a very important thing. One of the main points of my article is talking about the importance of public opinion. And so in the beginning, the HEA, the Hortonville teachers, they're the ones who really talked about protecting the community, being representatives of labor in the area, and standing up for, you know, the people of the community. And they kind of said that the Hortonville School Board were just these pawns of the state, the WASB, and even the national counterpart of that. And as the strike dragged on, as they brought in all of these protesters, and you had the teachers getting arrested for conducting these sit-ins, preventing the school buses from arriving in the morning with the children, it seemed a little odd that they were talking about representing the community when the school board was elected by the local officials and things got increasingly ugly. And so by a month into the strike, public opinion started swinging in favor of the school board. And again, they claim to represent the best interests of the community. And in turn, they said that the Hortonville teachers were just pawns of WEAC and the NEA.
We're talking to Adam Mertz about the Hortonville, Wisconsin teacher strike of 1974, one of the longest and most divisive education strikes in U.S. history.
And you can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your memories. What do you think of the role of public workers in Wisconsin since that strike? Were you following that story back in 1974, and what did you think of it at the time? Or were you maybe in Hortonville at the time? How did this conflict affect your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll continue the conversation after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with Adam Mertz about the Hortonville teacher strike of 1974 and what it meant for public sector workers then and now.
You can join in now at 800-642-1234. This is a story with echoes still today. What do you think about the relationship between the public and public employees, the state government and public workers? And if you have memories of the Hortonville strike, if you were in Wisconsin at the time, if you were in Hortonville at the time, maybe involved in it as a teacher, a local official, a parent, or even a student, call in with your memories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Adam, take us to the end of the strike story itself. How did it all conclude?
Sure. Eventually, it became clear, probably by the end of the 1973-74 school year, that the teachers weren't really going to win, though plenty of them stuck around. But really, a lot of representatives in the Hortonville district by the end of that school year were declaring victory, those who supported the board. But the court cases continued on in both at the local courts, then appealed to the state Supreme Court, and then even to the U.S. Supreme Court, which didn't reach a decision until June of 1976. And that decision favored the Hortonville School Board. And then at the state level for legislation, as a result of the Hortonville strike, a few other strikes by police officers and some other teachers in the next couple years, and WEAC actually voting in some labor-friendly legislators, we had the Mediation Arbitration Law of 1977. And in fact, that was more or less the law of the land from 1977 pretty much until Walker got rid of most of the collective bargaining rights in Act 10. And it was also known when it was passed as the Labor Peace Act. And really, there were no teacher strikes for 15 years after it was passed. And in Hortonville, things remain tense even now for people who are on opposing sides of the conflict. And I believe not up until about 10 years ago was there a teacher's local in Hortonville And now I believe there's one affiliated with AFT.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Marvin joining us in Hortonville. Marvin, hi.
Hi. Hello there.
Go ahead, Marvin.
The question, there is a AFT agency here right now, and they've only been negotiating salaries. They negotiated for 4 years the last time, 2 years at a time. So other than that, from 1974 to about 4 years ago, there was not a union here.
And Marvin, were you in Hortonville back in 1974 during the strike?
Oh yes, every day.
Were you involved in it in any way?
Well, as a superintendent of schools, I was the advisor to the. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
As the superintendent of schools, I was always the advisor to the school board about what they needed to know in information. And they did. I dealt with the attorneys a lot of times. I spent times in court. I had depositions of 8 hours. All those things were part of a strike.
What was it like to be in that position, be right in the thick of things?
Well, I was. Some nights you didn't sleep much. I had two 12-gauge shotgun shells, spent shells on my porch. I had the calls during the evening, robot calls that would be nasty telephone sexy calls and things of that nature. And the magazines sent to me that I never ordered, and same kinds of topics in those magazines. But yet we made it through that, I think, because we had a lot of local support.
Do you feel like Hortonville as a community has recovered from this really divided time?
Well, we don't talk about that much anymore, but I think the people are happy with the school system we have going now, and they don't like to talk about it, put it that way. It's just something that has passed, and during that period of time, the first few years, yes, there was a lot of animosities between the groups, but I don't hear too much about that anymore. Now when we talk about it, we just kind of, oh, the Hortonville strike, oh, yeah, we remember that.
And Marvin, before we let you go, what do you think about teachers' unions looking back now?
What about teachers' unions? Well, I came here 6 years before that, and we had to deal with the union then, and we got our contracts passed. But those were the days when they got their support from the state or national unions, and they got their direction from there. They did not get their own local initiatives there. They wanted to pass anything that the state or the national told them, you got to do this now for us. And so as a result, during that time, I guess you could say we just kind of hated the union, but it's a heck of a lot easier negotiating. I haven't negotiated lately here, the last 2 years or 4 years, but it's much easier one night and they're all finished.
Marvin, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your firsthand experience with us. Adam, your thoughts on what the superintendent at the time had to say, looking back.
Yeah, I'm very happy he called in. Thank you very much. That's what I've heard about. This is some of the thing I was talking about, having the outside sympathy protesters coming in and harassing local businesses. Also, the ordering of the magazines there. And again, I've looked at some of the interviews that happened, you know, about 6 months after that school year ended, and a lot of the people who said they supported the board, one of the biggest reasons they gave for supporting the board was because they didn't like what the sympathy protesters did who supported the Hortonville teachers. So that was a big swing in public opinion.
Talking to Adam Mertz about the Hortonville teacher strike of 1974. Back to our callers now. John is with us in Rice Lake. John, hi.
Well, hi there. Yes, I was at Hortonville several times during the strike, and every time I was there, the teachers were very passive in their protesting. But the these vigilantes carrying shotguns and rifles in the back of pickups driving around, they were somewhat intimidating. But this idea of teachers being disruptive towards the businesses, I never saw that.
John, thanks for the call. Adam, can you talk a little more about the Hortonville vigilantes and what they did, what their role was?
Sure. So everything that I've seen said that they, in addition to doing, you know, this general harassment that a lot of the protesting teachers complained about, they would escort the replacement teachers to and from the Hortonville schools. They would stage counter-protests, ones that actually supported the Hortonville board, and they just made their presence known. They made flyers, placards. They put some of them even kind of painted their vehicles to show their support for the board.
Well, Adam, looking at what this means for Wisconsin history, I mean, we hear about these tensions between the public and public employees. It was part of the whole Act 10 debate. Was this part of where this all started?
It's a big part. A lot of what was happening at the time, in addition to the restructuring in the NEA and WEAC, a lot of what was going on, these teachers connected themselves to the New Left movement and, to a certain extent, the Civil Rights movement, and that kind of gave them a lot of the momentum they felt they had to establish some of this. And a lot of what was going on in the economy, especially after 1973 when the Arab oil embargo happened, when a lot of people may remember waiting in gas lines at the gas station, the economy started to have a major downturn across the nation. And so in the midst of this whole Hortonville dispute, you saw people both in the Hortonville community and across the state talking about concerns over rising taxes and the economy and losing their jobs, and why should we, the taxpaying public, pay for increases in teacher salaries. And so you did see that a little bit replayed in the whole Act 10 battle with Walker's campaign promises and how the whole protest played out.
Briefly, Adam, kind of a where are they now story. Did the teachers who were fired in Hortonville teach there again? Did they teach elsewhere again? What happened to them briefly?
Some of them were returned to the Hortonville district, usually by court decisions. Some of them didn't go on strike initially, about four of them didn't, but the rest of them, they did not return to Hortonville.
We'll leave it there. Adam Mertz, thanks for joining us.